I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is best-selling author Maggie Anton, author of the new book, The Midwife's Escape. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. My wife Sophie, our daughter Ayelet, and I just returned from a vacation in Asia, visiting and touring with close friends who moved to Bangkok, Thailand. It was a great visit. We thoroughly enjoyed Thailand, a fascinating and enjoyable country. We were a little worried to be taking this trip with an almost two-year-old toddler. Ayelet turned to during our journey home. More about that in a moment, but it really was wonderful. First of all, I can tell you, if you want to gain a lot of attention in Malaysia, Thailand, and Japan, travel around with an extremely outgoing and friendly red-haired, blue-eyed toddler. It seemed like everybody in Asia was eager to take photos of and with this child. Red hair and blue eyes are not exactly common in the countries we visited, and people could not possibly have been warmer or more excited to post shots of themselves on, I think, their Instagram feeds and Facebook pages and other apps with our smiling and laughing little girl, who also loved the attention lavished on her everywhere. The other interesting detail about this trip for us was that Ayelet's birthday took place last Friday, February 7th. We were scheduled to travel home that day. We began flying out of Bangkok the day before, connecting through Kuala Lumpur, which meant that we left Malaysia near midnight, just before her birthday. So the entire 7-plus-hour flight to Japan, it was Ayelet's birthday. Then we spent about 14 or 15 hours in Japan, touring around Tokyo and so on, before heading back to the airport. It was still Ayelet's birthday. We boarded our flight back to the U.S. from Japan, about 10 hours, I think, during all of which it remained her birthday. We crossed the international dateline, and when we landed in Los Angeles, it was still her birthday. And finally, we flew home to Tucson, landing here at 10 p.m., and it was still our daughter's second birthday. She had, I believe, the longest birthday in human history, 39 hours long. Now that's amazing. You know, by the way, if you don't want to get any older, you could just reverse our trip on your birthday, starting in, say, Tahiti and flying to Fiji. You'd start around midnight and land the next day, an hour or so later, at midnight, completely missing your birthday. And you could then claim to stay the same age, right? While we were in Thailand, we saw beautiful temples, impressive ruins, lovely scenery, an amazing, complex, modern city in Bangkok with huge malls and phenomenal traffic jams. But my favorite sight was a place called the Sanctuary of Truth, a huge all-wooden building intricately carved and set in a fantastic coastal location near Pattaya. The Sanctuary of Truth in Thailand is the somewhat eccentric creation of a very wealthy Thai businessman. It serves a couple of important functions. It memorializes his own complex philosophy and theology, which blends Buddhist, Hindu, and other elements to emphasize the central truths of all existence as he sees them, and our human resistance to acknowledging and understanding them. And it also keeps vibrant and active the great Thai tradition of elaborate wood carving, since it has been under construction since, I am not making this up, 1981. It isn't quite finished, and it will have to be continuously restored and rebuilt forever. Wood doesn't last all that long in a location overlooking the sea in the Gulf of Thailand. Salt air, you understand. Well, I love the focus on truth in this building. in the whole physical structure, the ways it explains it. It dramatizes our own human ability to delude ourselves about what is and isn't real, and our ultimate requirement to face up to and accept truth. The Sanctuary of Truth has a great deal to teach us and to teach our current political leadership in this country about the importance of truth. I just wish they at least would listen. On a lighter note, it was Valentine's Day last Friday, a holiday that frankly is not Jewish. At least it didn't used to be Jewish. I was in Israel in February recently and was surprised Israelis seem to be celebrating Valentine's Day at least a bit now. There were balloons and hearts in some restaurants, and clearly it was a special date night of sorts there. Not quite the extravaganza of cards, flowers, chocolates, gifts, and perfume that V-Day has become in America. Nobody does commercial excess quite like the good old USA. But clearly there was some level of national buy-in in Israel, even in the only Jewish nation on the globe. Now, technically, the Jewish version of Valentine's Day is called Tu B'Av, and it comes in the summer on the 15th day of the calendar month Av on the Hebrew calendar. It's considered a romantic night to take out your sweetheart, but February 14th is apparently gaining on it. Still, the Valentine's Day festival is originally based on a Roman pagan fertility celebration, and it was renamed after a martyred Christian saint, or perhaps one of several, in the 3rd century. It only became associated with romance at all during the Middle Ages, and it was later repackaged into a shopkeeper's festival by the British. I mean, who else? In the 19th century. Nowadays, it's an excuse for restaurants to double their prices and hire a lot of temporary servers to meet the excessive demand for a fancy dinner out, for florists to work double time, for jewelry ads, and so on. Frankly, the last time we went out for Valentine's Day, I noticed that all the loving young couples seated around us were occupied throughout dinner with their phones, texting and looking at photos of other people than their dates. We live in a weird era. Well, this year Valentine's Day fell on Friday night, last Friday night, so it was Shabbat. The best kind of date night, in my opinion, is to go to services and enjoy music, candles, wine, and a pleasant meal, all provided by your local synagogue at no extra charge. In any case, to play us in this morning, here's my friend Joe Black's classic song, Valentine's Day is Not a Jewish Holiday. Explaining, well, you'll hear.
Valentine's Day is not a Jewish holiday. That's why I didn't buy you flowers. I was thinking just of you. I know you're proud to be a Jew. It's a most confusing 24 hours. No, I can't be what I ain't. And a day named for a saint doesn't seem to be a kosher celebration. Oh, but when Purim comes, we'll nash on special heart-shaped hamantaschen and drink Mulligan David wine for our libation. It's a Hallmark holiday, that is all that I can say. I don't know why you think it's so essential. Besides, at $80 a pop, a dozen roses ain't so high. What's the point of getting oh so sentimental? No, I didn't buy Godivas, 'cause the increase in your dress sizes from eating chocolate makes you weep and makes you wail. So open up the bedroom door, don't make me sleep here on the floor. I'll buy perfume for you next week when it's on sale.
That was Rabbi Joe Black singing Valentine's Day is Not a Jewish Holiday. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is the best-selling author of Maggie Anton, a frequent guest of Too Jewish. She's famous for her novels about medieval Jewish women scholars. Her new book, however, takes her in a quite different direction.
Maggie Anton, is definitely the most successful Jewish historical novelist that I can think of. Now, I know that's a niche, but still, very impressive. Her books on Rashi's Daughters, a trilogy, was wildly successful. She then was nominated for a National Jewish Book Award for Rav Chista's Daughter, Apprentice, and the sequel Enchantress. She has a new book out, and by the way, she did 50 Shades of Talmud, which we also talked to her about. Her new book is called The Midwife. Escape from Egypt to Jericho. Good morning and welcome back to Two Jewish.
I'm very glad to be back. Weather here in California is rather dreary, so fine with me. I'm staying indoors and talking to you.
Beautiful here in Arizona. So you spent a lot of time in the Middle Ages and to some degree in antiquity. You went much farther back for The Midwife's Escape. This is biblical stuff. Tell us what prompted you to dig back so far.
Our family has a tradition at Passover that as we're getting the table ready and all that, we watch Prince of Egypt, the animated.
Yeah, the DreamWorks SKG's still maybe the best movie on Exodus, if you come right down to it.
Yeah, well, I'm old enough that when I was younger, I saw Charlton Heston in Ten Commandments. The DreamWorks version, the moment when everybody, all the Israelites and a few hanger-ons are coming out of Egypt, you see the Egyptian guards drop their weapons and join them. So that really stuck in my mind. I mean, I knew that there was all this mixed multitude that came out with the Israelites, but I started thinking about, okay, who was that mixed multitude and what was in their minds and what was it like for them to be literally an outsider since they had to set up their tents outside the Israelite camp. Although by the time you get to Jericho, and boy, did I reread all that sections of Torah a lot.
Yeah.
By the time you get to Jericho, Joshua reminds us that nobody has been circumcised over the last 40 years.
That's right. Yeah, it's fascinating.
And all the men have to get circumcised right then and there, and they wait, and then they have to wait and heal, and then they're going to go take down Jericho. And that really impressed me that all of the people that entered became converts right then.
Yeah, and there's a whole dramatic scene. They have to renew their covenantal commitment in addition to the Brit Milah, the circumcision. We don't read that part very often, but we should.
Because Joshua, we end at
Deuteronomy.
And reading Joshua was an interesting experience. I'm not sure that I had ever read.
Like a lot of knowledgeable Jews, even. By the way, we have a class that I teach called the Joshua Project. We'd finished doing the five books really carefully and slowly, and now we've been digging into Joshua ourselves, and it is fascinating. We will talk much more with Maggie Anton. Her new book is called The Midwife's Escape from Egypt to Jericho, and it traces, well, it's a great story. We'll talk more about it. We come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter and into the spring. Established 6 years ago by terrific congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, Friday night and Saturday, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. Religious schools available for school-aged children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bar mitzvah programs, Torah Tykes experience, confirmation, and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org to sign up. Our services, classes, and events welcome everybody. Join us Friday night, 6:30 p.m. services, always followed by a delicious Onig Shabbat, very musical services with our Shabbat musicians, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m. Our Facebook page, where you can also watch our services, is Beit Simcha Tucson, BEITSIMCHA Tucson. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tykes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person or on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing and most dynamic Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes stores, very popular Jewish podcast, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over, well, 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, there's been a lot in the news about a place that's sort of close to my heart, the Australian Jewish community. I worked there for a while once, and there'd been a kind of dramatic increase in anti-Semitism, not just anti-Israel, certainly that fuels it, but some really dramatic and unfortunate incidents. It's a really interesting community, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, there's been a dramatic increase of anti-Semitism all over the world.
Yeah, worldwide.
There's no reason to particularly focus on Australia other than that we both know it and love it. And it's not only a result of October 7th and all the events that have followed that. It is part of a wider, I think, global phenomenon of countries with large immigrant populations starting to experience a backlash against those immigrants. And this is not limited to foreign countries. This is true in our own country. There's a huge backlash against immigrants, and they're taking our jobs.
In Britain, in France, in Germany.
Even in New Zealand, in Hungary, in Italy. I mean, all kinds of places. Let's make it clear that we're not pointing the finger at Australia or saying they're bad people.
Sure.
Because this seems to be, unfortunately, a global phenomenon.
Now I would say it's coming kind of from both directions. In addition to the sort of revival of anti-immigrant, which means somehow anti-Semitism, even in places where Jews have been for many, many years and centuries, even
they're still viewed as foreigners. They're outsiders.
Also, the anti-Israel aspects of this and the left side of the anti-Semitism is just as virulent, if not more so. And that's where some of the most problematic stuff has come out lately. I think about it in Australia because Australia has so many immigrants. You note that it's really a nation of immigrants, right?
Yeah, and it's very much a settler nation. It's what the world accuses Israel of being.
Right.
They dispossessed
it was a colony.
The locals.
Absolutely.
And they kind of imprisoned the kids in these horrible schools, and they
did terrible things.
Locked them behind fences, and it's not a pretty story.
But the response it's not like Aboriginals are leading the anti-Semitic wave there, but...
No, not at all.
But it has been, because it's a place of immigration from, there's a large Lebanese population. It's really
There's a ton of Italians and Greeks and people from the former Yugoslavia, but also... closer to home from the Australian point of view, there's, you know, millions of Vietnamese, Chinese,
right,
the large overpopulated Asians of East Asia who come for work.
From Hong Kong before the Chinese took over. I mean, there's just there's a large immigration.
Right.
And it's caused, I think, some of the expressions of the challenges in a very cosmopolitan place like Australia. It's not all cosmopolitan, but it's definitely a mixture of populations, has been finding a balance point. And that has, I think, fueled a fair amount of anti-Semitism at this point.
Two important distinctions between Australia and our own country. The Australian Jewish community is a much more recent phenomenon.
Right,
I mean,
for sure.
There have been Jews in the United States since before there was a United States of America.
Right.
There were Jewish settlers and immigrants at least in the 18th century, if not also the 17th. And some Jewish communities are very old. Even my hometown synagogue, within a couple of weeks, is celebrating its 140th birthday.
Right.
So they've been there a while.
Yeah.
Most Australian Jews came there as a result of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
Not every single one, but
no,
the vast majority.
Yeah.
And they wanted to get as far away from Europe as possible, which is why also a lot of Jews ended up in New Zealand, because that's even further. Now, we can talk about different Australian communities next week.
Okay, sounds good, Tom. We'll do that.
Okay, look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. David complained to his doctor that after 22 years, his sex life was not exciting, and his wife Sadie also didn't get excited. The doctor gave him advice. Look, try this. As soon as you get home from work and Sadie opens the door, throw her on the floor, rip off her clothes, and have your way with her. The next week, David returned to the doctor, who asked, David, did you do what I said? Yes, doctor, David replies. And did Sadie enjoy it? Asked the doctor. Yes, says David, but maybe not as much as her Mahjong group did. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, Just For You, You Should Live and Be Well. Another one of those jokes I can never use from the pulpit. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion of Mishpatim includes as many laws as any part of the whole Torah. After the last few weeks of spectacularly dramatic portions featuring some of the greatest highlights in the entirety of Jewish tradition, indeed in all religious history, Mishpatim could come as a major letdown. Last week, amid the smoke and thunder at Mount Sinai, we received the Ten Commandments. The week before, God parted the sea for us. We miraculously crossed on dry land. In the weeks before that, 10 plagues struck the Egyptians. Pharaoh and Moses had a duel of wills in the desert. There was a burning bush.
so much. But mishpatim is nothing more than a collection of laws, how we are supposed to interact with other human beings. Civil legislation. How exciting. How to handle someone else's property fairly, how to assess punitive damages for a person who injures another person or destroys somebody's property, how to act when somebody puts his or her property in trust with you, laws of manslaughter, theft, damages. Boring laws, many of them tediously detailed, and I don't know about you, but I don't really like reading law books. Now, if the Torah is truly our fundamental moral text, this is an array of detailed legislation about human interaction that seems sometimes so trivial as not to belong in the Torah at all. So why do we have mishpatim here? Human beings have, in general, no great love of law, or lawyers usually, but without laws and without enforcement, we fallible creatures wouldn't function at all. In fact, the Mishnah tells us we would tear each other apart. Where anarchy reigns, justice doesn't. And that's where mishpatim comes in. For we need law, and we need limits, although we might not like either one much. Judaism understands that if we are to be truly good or truly free, we must observe the laws and rules of human decency, embodied in the code of legislation that makes up mishpatim. Before we can love another human being as we love ourselves, we must respect that human being's property and person. Before we can make this world holy, we must treat each other with civility. It is a great fundamental lesson we seem to need to relearn in every generation, perhaps especially in our own. A final note. At the end of this week's Parsha, after all the rules and laws of Mishpatim, the torts and talionises, God reveals a glimpse of the divine essence to Moses. Why here? Well, because Mishpatim teaches we can only experience real holiness when we begin by respecting our fellow men and women. When we come to understand that we are all in this together. That the way to God is through the ways we learn to work together and trust one another. And we must do this in simple, practical, daily ways by following decent rules for human interaction. Freedom and holiness are dependent on the little laws established in Mishpatim, on the civility that rules require. Our public discourse has become coarse and ugly in recent years. It is civility that allows us to interact with the many disparate people in our society in productive and healthy ways. May we all remember that this week and every week. When we come back in just a moment, our guest, best-selling author Maggie Anton, tells us how she was able to get into the life experiences of important women way back in Torah times. Find out when we return in a moment right here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
As the exchange of Israeli hostages for tons of Palestinian terrorist murderers continues, other stories continue to emerge from the Gaza war. Israel has obtained a series of internal documents exchanged between Hamas operatives in Gaza and producers at the Qatari news network Al Jazeera. Those documents reveal Hamas's attempt to alter its narrative surrounding the October 7th attack and the mass atrocities and murders it committed. Well, those are being abetted and aided by Al Jazeera. A report published by the Meir Amit Intelligence and Terrorism Information Center, part of the Intelligence Heritage and Commemoration Center, presents some materials seized by the IDF, the Shin Bet, and the IDF Intelligence Directorate. Those documents expose direct communication between senior Hamas terrorists in Gaza and Al Jazeera producers. The report says that the broadcast of a recent Al Jazeera investigative program,
was aimed to reinforce Hamas's narrative of victory following the ceasefire in Gaza and to justify the October 7th atrocities as a legitimate military operation. The program sought to cement the image of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar as a warrior leader who remained on the front lines until his death. The exclusive footage of Sinwar on the battlefield in Rafah, alongside rare recordings of Hamas military commander Mohammed Deif, provided further evidence of the deep ties between Hamas and Al Jazeera, the report says. It references previous exposures of Al Jazeera journalists who were members of Hamas's military wing, that is, terrorists themselves, and the network's privileged access to footage of Israeli hostages being released recent weeks. January 24, 2025, just a couple weeks ago, Al Jazeera aired a special episode of its investigative program, What is Hidden is Greater, focusing on the October 7th Hamas terrorist-Palestinian atrocities from the perspective of the Palestinian terrorist group's military wing. The Al Jazeera broadcast included new details about the attack's planning, testimonials from Hamas field commanders and operatives, and footage of Mohammed Deif in the command room. Deif, of course, was eventually killed by the IDF. The show also featured Yahya Sinwar walking through Rafah's battleground before he too was killed in September of 2024. The program echoed Hamas's lies that the attack was aimed solely at Israeli military personnel and that the group intended only to capture soldiers while avoiding harm to civilians, particularly children and the elderly. Well, the facts are that Hamas deliberately targeted the elderly and children and murdered children in front of their parents and murdered parents in front of their children. Hamas used the Al Jazeera broadcast to reinforce its quote-unquote victory narrative, legitimizing its actions on October 7th as a military operation instead of the brutal war crime atrocities they were and remain. The broadcast also emphasized Hamas's messaging that the attack was a religious jihad justified by Islam, portraying Palestinian terrorist resilience, heroism, and sacrifice as the key to the success of Al-Aqsa Flood, Hamas's codename for the terrorist atrocities it perpetrated. It framed the attack as a historic moment where Palestinians refused to surrender to oppression and aggression, making sacrifices for their faith, homeland, and Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is in Jerusalem, of course, far from Gaza, playing no part whatsoever in the events. This Al Jazeera, PR, made absolutely no mention of the widespread instances of Hamas Palestinian terrorists perpetrating rape, torture, arson, kidnapping, and the murder of children and the elderly on October 7th. One of the program's key visual elements was the footage of Sinwar, portraying him as a hands-on battlefield leader directing combat. The Israeli report concludes Al Jazeera played a crucial role amplifying Hamas's strategic messaging, helping shape public perception and whitewashing Hamas's brutal war crimes under the guise of investigative journalism. Frankly, Al Jazeera should be banned from distribution in all civilized countries. In other news, Israeli hostage Eli Sharabi, who was released last week after nearly 500 days in Hamas captivity, was reportedly unaware his wife and two daughters were murdered by Hamas Palestinian terrorists on October 7th. He learned of their deaths only after his release from Gaza. Hamas also informed Sharabi of the death of his brother Yossi as he was being paraded on stage in Deir el-Bala in central Gaza. His brother's body is still being held in Gaza by the brutal Palestinian terrorists of Hamas. Sharabi told the IDF soldiers he was looking forward to meeting his wife, Leanne, and their daughters, Noya and Yahel, unaware that they had all been brutally murdered in their home in Be'eri in the October 7th massacre, both the mother and the two teenage daughters, as Hamas terrorists dragged him into the Gaza Strip. Eli is returning from an impossible reality in captivity to a very difficult reality in Israel, his kibbutz Be'eri, said in a statement. And elsewhere, after last week's viral circulation of a video of two Australian nurses claiming to have murdered Israeli patients and threatening to kill more, the Sydney area practitioners of medicine have been suspended. The New South Wales Police Force's Anti-Semitism Task Force has taken over the investigation, interviewing staff,
and seizing CCTV footage. It's identified the likely location within Bankstown Hospital, where a male nurse told Israeli English teacher and social media influencer Max Pfeiffer, "You have no idea how many Israeli dogs have come to this hospital, and I sent them to hell. I won't treat them, I'll kill them," said a female nurse in a hijab, according to a post of a random video chat interaction Pfeiffer posted on his social media account. That video has been temporarily suspended on Instagram. The female nurse expressed her hope that he would remember her face when he died the most disgusting death, trailing off into expletives. "It's Palestine's country, not your country, you piece of etc., said the nurse. The male nurse, who claimed to be a doctor, said at the outset of the conversation, "You have beautiful eyes, but I'm upset that you're Israeli. Eventually, when you're killed, you're going to hell." As Australian and Israeli officials and Jewish citizens expressed outrage, New South Wales Police Force Commissioner Karen Webb said Strike Force Pearl was investigating the matter. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said the Australian Federal Police offered whatever assistance to the state police they could provide. "This is a sad day for our country," said Karen Webb. "It is unthinkable that we are confronted with and forced to investigate such an appalling incident." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Maggie Anton, the award-winning author of Rashi's Daughters, and in particular the new book, The Midwives' Escape from Egypt to Jericho. Maggie, in a way, you write the forgotten stories, right? The people we get introduced to and then don't know what happened.
Right, and in this case, we know there's a mixed multitude that comes out with the Israelites.
The Erev Rav.
Yes, the Erev Rav. It sounds so onomatopoeic when you have words that sound together like that. And if we read all of Joshua carefully, we would find out that at least the men in the Erev Rav get, along with all the Israelites who hadn't gotten circumcised during the 40 years, which was all of them, the men have to get circumcised before they go into Jericho. That happens, and they lay around for a few days to recover, and then they take down Jericho. Most people, at least of our age, know that song. You know, Joshua fought.
Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, right?
Yeah, and the walls came tumbling down. So I was always curious, like, who was that Erev Rav? What made them leave? How did they manage those 40 years? And then when I started doing some research to learn a little bit more about that, I realized that the Torah leaves out 35 of those 40 years.
Right.
It's like, wait a second, all of a sudden they find out that none of the old guys are dying anymore and it's time to go. But wait, what? Anyway, so my imaginative brain started thinking, well, what did happen? And I came up with the idea to write another historical novel. And as opposed to Prince of Egypt and the Ten Commandments, my book pretty much starts when they leave Egypt. I thought, okay, let's see what, you know, and for me, the research is the fun part and the writing is the hard work. I had never researched this part of Israelite history, and I had the great luck of discovering the Biblical Archaeology Society, which puts out, first of all, it's been around for like 50 years.
Right. Right.
And they put out a very nice magazine.
BAR, Biblical Archaeology Review. Yep.
You know, four times a year. And to be an all-access subscriber, frankly, to me, is not a huge amount of money, and it's a charity anyway. And then you have access online to everything they have ever printed and every seminar they've ever given. Boy, I was sitting on my computer looking up stuff that they had. Then also I moved on to, once I found out who the biblical scholars were, of course they all have websites and they have articles and they have books, and I started reading about the other nations, societies that were around at that time, you know, the Hittites, the Nubians, anyway, there were quite a lot of them, and the pieces of a puzzle that make up a story started coming to my mind. And I decided I would focus on, of course, my main characters are going to be women. That's, sorry, guys.
Well, I think since in the Bible the main characters are mostly men, it's only fair.
Right, and it also means if I'm going to create stories and essentially make up stuff, the women are much better candidates because the Torah doesn't tell us that much.
Right.
I can use my imagination to figure that out. But, you know, to call myself a scholar is, there's a lot greater scholars than me, but scholars have been looking at this for a long time, and most of us probably who are friends of Bible study have read Richard Elliot Friedman's Who Wrote the Bible.
Right. Another past guest of Too Jewish, I have to add.
Yeah. He also wrote more recently
Exodus Revisited. Yeah.
About the Exodus.
Exactly. Yep.
Which, of course, I had not even heard of that until I was, you know, looking up people to ask for blurbs. And I thought, oh my goodness, I got to read that. And there's been a lot of reevaluating and archaeology done trying to figure out, was there an Exodus? If so, when did it happen? How did it happen? I think most scholars have said that the number of Israelites who left Egypt, the Bible says, is like over 600,000.
Well, 600,000 adult males, which would be like, I don't know, 2.5 million people or something. It's not a possible number, really.
Right, especially the entire population of Egypt wasn't even 2 million people
right.
in those days.
Right.
So already I get to think, okay, well, I got to, you know, figure that out. Anyway, I really jumped into the rabbit hole in terms of who were the mixed multitude. There were the Hittites, who apparently were the greatest warriors at the time, and they often hired themselves out as mercenaries when their country, Anatolia, wasn't actually fighting anybody. And they were in Egypt. Actually, we know they were in Israel because King David, in a not very complimentary story, sends Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite, out to be at the front of the guard so that he would die and David could marry Bathsheba. But anyway, that's way later. Anyway, so I found that there were all these other groups. So that was another big piece of research. Like, who were the Hittites? Who were the Nubians? Where did they live? What, you know? And so that was kind of neat, because the Nubian warriors were women. They were archers on horseback, also mercenaries, if they had an opportunity. So then I got to research on them. But the land that I was researching came to be the lands I was researching. I wasn't expecting to
get
into all these other people. But then I had to learn also. I decided, okay, I'm going to make my women heroines midwives. That way, they have to talk to everybody. They have to go into all the tents. They have a profession that is necessary for humanity. So then I had to look up how did the midwives of that time and place, what were they like? And there was actually plenty of information about that. I was rather astonished to learn that the midwives, even back in like 1000 BCE in Egypt, they had some kind of potion or medicine that would cause an abortion that didn't appear to be a...
some sort of abortive factor of some kind, yeah.
And also, I don't know whether the Egyptians invented these or they were the only ones that we have the artifacts to know that they had them. They had forceps, which we think of as a modern midwife tool. And I know because my daughter, my first child, had to get pulled out of there with modern forceps. But anyway, they had them back in the, you know, those Egyptian times, which is, oh, great, I got to write a scene about that. I mean, whenever I learn something new, I have to put it into a book so that other people, you know, the readers will also learn something new. And I decided, of course, that my heroine's husband and first one and only son at the time of the 10th plague, I'm going to kill them off. So that, you know, the mother and daughter we can have romances here. And speaking of romances, I learned about a people called the Lagash, who...
Yeah, the Pilagshim, the people that we think are the Philistines, right?
No, the Lagash are to the east. They're like between Babylonia and...
Ah, all right.
Anyway, so they're out there, and I can't even remember how I found out about them, but they were obviously in one of the many books that I read about what life was like in the Middle East in those days. And it turns out that unlike the Israelites, and frankly most peoples back then, where a man could have more than one wife, for the Lagash, where they had a shortage of women and a surplus of men, the Lagash women got to have two husbands at the same time, although they had to be brothers. And the problem with the Lagash is their land apparently was so unfertile that if they had too many children, then nobody would inherit enough good land that they could make a living of it. Anyway, this went way back, and I thought, oh, gosh, I got to throw that in there. At least my female readers will love it. And it turns out that the woman who's going to have more than one husband, they have to be brothers, so that what little land there was stays
within the family or the clan.
Exactly. Not quite like the daughters of Zelophehad, who also make an appearance.
Yes, they do.
That was fun writing about them and thinking about what it would have been like. I mean, Hebrew, you know, Israelite men, many of them had more than one wife, and all the way into like modern times, even.
Well, yeah. I did. Quick question: in developing the story of Shifra and Pua and the midwives, as you move forward, what was the most challenging aspect you had, because you're drawing from stories that exist in the Torah and then taking them forward? What's the hardest thing?
The hardest thing is trying to decide, am I going to put in something that could contradict Torah, even though that would make the story better, and we're not following the Torah as history, and since a lot isn't known. But I tried not to be too much something contradictory. I wanted to...
Kind of the way Midrash sort of edits itself from time to time.
Yes, we don't want to say bad things about Moses and Miriam and...
Unless the Torah does it itself, actually.
Yeah, which the Torah does.
Which it does.
So where that was in there. And I saw no reason not to invent a sibling rivalry, because that's how every sibling...
Yeah, I don't think you have to invent that concept, Maggie.
Yeah. So I made Aaron the bad guy.
I can understand that. I feel like we could go on considerably longer. Maggie, where can people go to find out more about you, about your work, and about this fascinating new book, The Midwives Escape?
Well, I have a website, the same website I've had, oh my goodness, 20 years.
Wow.
Since the first Rashi's Daughters came out. And it's www.maggieanton.com. And I have and there you'll find a link to The Midwives Escape website, which is midwivesescape.com. And on both of those websites, there'll be lots of information, there'll be reviews, there'll be discussion questions, and of course you can go to Amazon and look up
Maggie Anton and The Midwives Escape. Maggie, thanks so much. Best of luck on the new book, and look forward to talking again on your next project.
Yes. Okay, thank you for inviting me to be on your program, and I'll be back in Arizona soon.
You'll have to come visit.
Yes.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470.
While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470 to speak to a family advisor at Evergreen. Call 520-888-7470. Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Professor Richard Daynard, an important crusader against the addiction of sports betting, as he was a crucial player in taking down Big Tobacco. And please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, in person and available on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish, it's a prayer for the welfare of the soldiers of the IDF, sung by cantor Netanel Hershtick, by the Maccabees, and children's choirs from around the world. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Avraham, Yitzchak, v'Yaakov,
אדוני את אויבינו הקמים עלינו ניגפים לפניהם.
הקדוש ברוך הוא ישמור ויציל את חיילינו מכל צרה וצוקה, מכל נגע ומחלה, וישלח ברכה והצלחה בכל מעשה ידיהם. ידבר שונאינו תחתיהם, ויתרם בכתר ישועה ובעטרת ניצחון, ויקוים בהם הכתוב.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.